Good evening. My name's Kurt, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to welcome Omar. If you're early in recovery or if this is your first meeting, I hope you hear something that keeps you coming back. Maybe not from me, but from some of the others you've heard share. And Brad, welcome from another meeting. The birthday meetings, the birthday girls, Heidi, Lindy, and Ann, congratulations. What, 11, 21, 30, in three different decades. So good on you. I'd like to thank Glenn for inviting me up here. I spoke up here a little over a year, year and a half ago. I've spoken up here through much of my sobriety through the years. I used to live up in San Luis Obispo, and I've always loved this club. I did a lot of sobriety in the Central Coast, and just come down here and see all the old-timers, which I don't see too many of them around anymore. I know some of them have gotten older and can't make it out sometimes, but it's always a pleasure to be in this meeting. And it's kind of a cozy little intimate meeting. I didn't always live in Ojai. I moved there about 5 years ago. And I had done a lot of sobriety, like I said, up in San Luis Obispo, but my story really goes back much further than that. I was pretty much born into an alcoholic family. My father was a really good, wonderful businessman, bright spirit. Everybody liked him. My mom was the same thing. She was a really hardworking individual. My father came from Sweden. He emigrated here in 1954 and naturalized in 1958. My mother was up in Seattle, Washington, and lived out in the rural countryside and in the city, and she grew up through the Depression up there. And they both met in San Francisco, got married and started a family, and I was the only child. Both hardworking, great people. The only problem was when they started drinking, it became hell. And I'll share this with you. I'm the one that did the drinking in my story. I'm not putting it on anybody else. But I can tell you there were several things that led up to a lot of dysfunction in my own personal emotional being. Some of my earliest recollections are living up in a little town called Belmont, California. And there'd be the fights going on at 6, 7 o'clock, you know, at night when all the drinking's going on. And invariably, someone would be sleeping on the couch or in the easy chair. It would be either my father or my mother. And I'd be out there, I'd crawl out of bed, and I'd sleep next to one of them. I will fast forward to one thing. Because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have been able to go through all these issues, all the causes and effect of everything. I absolutely adore my parents today. No matter what I tell you about what's gone on, I absolutely adore them for what they did give me. And that will come out in my story as well. But needless to say, you know, back in the 60s, you know, they weren't the hippies. They were more like the yuppies. It was more of the martini lunches. It was the, you know, the moving and the shaking. You know, my dad was working in the airlines. He was working his way up as a company man. He became very successful. And my mother was a top administrative secretary, and she became very successful. And then they moved down to Los Angeles in 1970. But I was already pretty messed up inside. I can tell you that I didn't understand a lot of things. And sometimes you'll hear in meetings people talk about this big hole inside of them, and that's what was there. I didn't like the drinking. I didn't like the fighting. You know, I liked some of the fun things that we got to do. My father was in the airline, so I got to travel a lot. But wherever I went, I felt very alone or awkward or isolated or different, and even in a crowded room, even at an early age. I just didn't get along with a lot of the other kids. I had sort of these hostage friendships. I had one at a time. You know, I didn't know how to participate in a social group. I would feel very strange. But again, I had no idea what the heck was going on with me. And as I was getting older, and my parents were progressing through their careers, they were also progressing through their alcoholism. And I was telling myself at the age of 11, 12, 13, I'm never going to drink like that. I'm never going to smoke cigarettes. I'm not going to do any of this stuff. I have no idea what these people are doing. You know, I saw their friends, I liked their friends, but, you know, it was always after that second or third drink, that second or third round during a party, the noise would go up, and then the weird voices and strange conversations and the weird jokes would come out, and I'm like, I don't want to do any of this stuff. But I thought I was an adult, and I wanted to participate at the same time. So I was pretty messed up. So fast forward a little bit. I had buried myself off in tennis. I was a tennis player at an early age, and I just would be out on the court, and that's all I would do. I was very good, I was very athletic, but I really just wanted to be out there. I mean, I would just train and practice and practice and train, and just I wanted to be off on my own little world. And things were starting to get really, really bad in my mid-teens, and my mother goes and gets sober, and she goes off to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hadn't even had a drink yet, and I'm already going off to meetings with her. And I liked it. I immediately liked the people in the rooms. I saw the smiles. My mom was this beautiful, elegant woman, and yet she's talking to some guy in a trench coat, and they're having a cup of coffee laughing. And I'm thinking, okay, Mom, I don't know what's wrong with you, but you seem to like these people. Okay, but I was very blessed and very fortunate that the man that 12-stepped me is a man named Norm Albee. And on 1976, he told my story, he told my family story. And I fell in love with AA somehow, inside. But I didn't understand the drinking part. I didn't want to drink. And I didn't understand once you start drinking what happens. So my mom got sober, but what happens with alcoholism, and she got sober and my dad didn't, that didn't mean everything got rosy in the house. In fact, my mother used to share, I remember being at a big speaker meeting, about 200, 250 people down in LA. She gets up there and she goes, "Hi, my name's Beverly. I'm an alcoholic, and had my husband not been an asshole, I wouldn't be here today." And I thought, what? You know, geez, what did you just say? You know, and I'm thinking, here comes the dirty laundry. Here comes, you know, here comes, it's all coming out now. And she goes, "Yeah, because had he made it easy for me and sat in the couch and said, 'Let's not drink tonight, honey,' she said she would have sat right and nestled into that couch and not gone and got recovery. But since he was adamant about her drinking, she said, 'Forget you, I'm sober, I'm in AA.' And her home group said, 'You're also getting in service.'" So one of the first things she ever did was she was out at Chino Women's, Maximum Security, Civil Brand, and all that. Every Wednesday night, they were taking the Diamond Lane when it was the Diamond Lane, and they would pack up two or three of them, and they'd head out there, and she'd go out to Maximum Security every Wednesday night. I was, like, flabbergasted. So during that first couple years, she still had what we have, a little bit of that. You know, we get a little of that guilt and remorse while we're working through our stuff in our early sobriety, you know, so we could still kind of push the buttons and wrap her around our finger a little bit. And I kind of sided with my dad on a few things because I thought, you know, she's getting a little strict. She's bringing some program in the house and I'm not liking it. And I couldn't play her. And shortly after, though, I could tell something inside of me was itching to run. I needed to go find something. I needed to go walk on the wilds. I needed to do something different. So I started hanging around some of the guys that were drinking, you know, and I didn't like it. I didn't like those people, but I had my first drink and something changed inside of me that day. Everything got quiet. That hole, that wind that had been going through me that I never knew was there, all of a sudden stopped. Now, I vividly remember what Normie A. had said in his pitch one time. He says, you know, it starts out with fun, then there's a little fun with trouble, and there's nothing but trouble. I went to trouble immediately, and I couldn't understand what was going on. I remember when we ordered that first case of beer, there was four of us, and there was a local liquor store that would deliver, and you could be underage. And they'd show up at the door, and there was four of us, and we had a six-pack each. And I finished my six-pack before they finished their first beer. And I was looking at theirs. It didn't faze me that that's not what we do as normal, non-alcoholic people. I didn't know it was a huge sign of alcoholism. All I know was I wanted more. So I progressed and I started drinking more and drinking heavier and going around and doing a lot of driving and getting caught and arrested and the blackouts and everything else. But I kept trying to quiet everything down inside, and everything would quiet down while I was drinking. And then as I'd sober up, the noise would get louder, and then I'd also have to face all the trouble I had just caused. And I couldn't understand why. And they were trying to tell me, look, you got a problem. I'm thinking, no, I don't. I can't get enough in me. That's the problem. you know, and then, so there was jails and rehabs and going to meetings and all these things. And I'll explain a little bit more about why that's so important for anybody that's new in a little bit. But I couldn't understand what was wrong. I couldn't understand why I still didn't fit. I just figured, stop getting caught. So I would take my stuff up into the mountains with a couple friends. After several years, I didn't want to even bring the friends with me. It's just me up there by myself or in the deserts or out by the beach. And I'd camp out and I'd bring enough stuff for a week or two. And it's like, you people over there and I'm over here and I'm not getting in trouble and I don't like you. But now pretty soon I'm probably going to have to come back and rip you off to get more stuff. So I guess I kind of got to play the game and then I'd be out on the road again. And that's pretty much how a lot of my 20s went. There was one little spot in there. I had met this girl. You know, that exact moment when you're supposed to break up, we said, I do. And and a couple months later, she couldn't find me to divorce me, you know, and I was just gone. And I remember my mother was telling her, my son's an alcoholic. You need to stay away from him. And you need to go to Al-Anon. She goes, I don't need Al-Anon. She goes, yeah, you do. And we were just a catastrophe. But those final days, I was sort of in an abandoned Volvo. It ran periodically. The brake master cylinder didn't work. I'd be driving down Los Angeles, and the seat was rotting out, you know, and I'd just be sitting a little lower and lower as the day went on. And I'd park it out by the airport, you know, and behind trees and bushes and trying to hide from the world. And basically I was an animal looking for a place to die is what I really was doing. But I was out there and I'd pull it all together to go get something or whatever. And I'd be driving down Los Angeles and I figured I must be a genius because I'm having to time the lights on Wilshire Boulevard because the brakes weren't working and I'd have to open the door to put my foot out and stop that last little bit right before the red light, you know. And then I thought I had it going on, you know, and I thought I was a golf professional at the time. So I was breaking into golf courses in the middle of the night thinking, okay, I've got no money, but look how bright I am. I'm not spending all those green fees. I'm out there playing in the dark, man. I'm going to be golden when the lights come on. I'm going to be so good. And I was out there hiding in the trees and hiding from the coyotes. And I was just out there. I was just gone. And I knew inside, though, I went past the do not pass go. I knew that. I went way past that stop sign. And there was no way of crawling back to, hey, guys, I can be fixed. I was thinking death was the next best stop for me. But I was just too chicken to pull the trigger or drive off a cliff. You know, and I didn't like me and I didn't like you and I didn't know what the heck was going wrong with me. But I could tell you, every time I drank, it all went away. The voices would quiet. So I really just had to keep pounding it into me. For some strange reason, I showed up in a place I would not normally show up, and an old friend's house. And there was a guy that showed up who would not normally be there. And they said, hey, he needs help with a ride with his car. Can you make a few bucks and piggyback the car with him, you know, and bring the car back, drop off a car? I said, sure. So I go with them, and they take me to a ward. And I can remember being on the gurney while they're pronouncing me dead. And I'm thinking, what? And they're talking. The doctors are talking. They're going, he's not going to wake up. Give him the sedatives, but he's not coming around. And obviously that's not what happened, but 4 days later I woke up on that gurney. And I looked around, and I saw the bathroom, and I fell off the gurney. I started crawling towards the bathroom over there. And I remember the doctor and the nurse looking down at me, and the look on their face was, he lived, and the look back on my face without saying a word was, of course I did. That's what we do. You know, it was still in there, the attitude, the you don't understand me. Okay, I've still got it going on somewhere, but maybe I have to mind my P's and Q's. Maybe I have to play the game a little differently. Maybe I don't get something. And one thing in my story, and I've heard thousands and thousands of stories, is I never once really tried to control my drinking in the sense of, oh, I'll just get it under wraps and I'll make it good and everybody get off my back or whatever. I was like, no, I'm not alcoholic. That never registered with me. And the reason I said what it meant earlier was about, I'd been to meetings, I'd seen old timers, I'd been in jail, I had been rehabbed, I had seen what AA is great. I've heard all the stories with all my mom and all my mom's friends and my uncles and all these other old timers in the program. And I guarantee you, there's no way I would have agreed with you that I was alcoholic. It didn't compute. But shortly after that, I was sitting in that rehab for a little while, and I had this moment of clarity. Where it came from, why it came from, I don't know, and I don't, you know, profess to say it's anything different than anybody else's, but on that particular day, I thought about it, and I felt this sense of hope come in me, and I was wondering what had just happened. But the great obsession of every alcoholic is he's going to control and enjoy his drinking. And that's the moment where I thought, oh, maybe I need to control this. Something changed inside. There was a little bit of life. At the same time, it's like, here's your alcoholism full blown. And I had to battle with that for a few more days. And then I got another bright light. And all I can tell you is I heard something similar to, there's a reason for you. And the next moment, I couldn't imagine people drinking or smoking or stealing. I didn't get it. It was that much of a 180. But I still don't know what the heck to do with myself. I mean, I was just over 100 pounds. You know, I'm driving this Volvo with no brakes still. And I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And I called that soon-to-be then ex-wife. And she said, why don't you go to that 8-8 thing? I thought, I can go to AA. How do I find AA? My mom's an old-timer. All the old-timers that used to hang out at my house, you know, all the Chuck and John Ackland's my uncle, and all these other people would come through, and Eddie H., and all these other people. I was like, we're anonymous. How do I find us? I have no clue as to how to find us. And no one ever told me we're in the phone book. You know, I mean, I had no clue. And then I remembered an old-timer meeting on Ohio Street, out in West Los Angeles. And I drove the car there, and it made there, and then it died. And I walked in the building, I looked around, it was like this, it was bright, people were attentive, there was glow in their eyes, I knew I was in a good spot, I could feel the energy, and I was like, I'm not leaving the building. I don't dare. So, after the meeting, I haven't shared this part in a long time, but there was an older black gentleman, really tall, and he was the secretary, and I walked up to him afterwards, and I said, I think I need a meeting schedule. He goes, how long you been sober, boy? You know, he looked up and down his glasses like, what the hell did the cat drag in, you know? And I said, one day. And he goes, you better get down on your knees and pray like you've never prayed before. And I thought, well, let's not get carried away. I'm here, you know? And God's honest truth, I turned around and I thought, don't you ever not listen to what these people say. And I went back to this little flea-bit no-tell, and I got on my knees. And I said, I don't know what just happened, but I've been sober one whole day. And I slept. I had not slept in 15 years, literally. And I got up in the morning, and I threw open the curtains. Now, I was living in an abandoned Volvo with towels and newspapers out by the airport, right? Because I was sure when the 747s took off, the captain was radioing in my position, because that's how paranoid I am. And here I just threw open the curtains, right? And there was light, and then I made the bed. And then I went, now what do? I don't know nothing about nothing. So I got a cup of coffee, and I'd had that meeting scheduled from the night before, and I started hunting down meetings. And I mean, I hunted them down, because I was like, I did not want to keep what I had brought to AA. No way. Someone grabbed me on my sixth day of sobriety, and he said, have you gotten rid of these resentments? Have you written your letter and all this stuff yet? And I thought, what are you talking about? because you've been talking about all this stuff, these resentments, this fear, this anger. What are you talking about all this stuff? And I go, well, I don't know. He goes, to this day, I don't know who it was, but it was some famous comedian. It was at the Improv in Santa Monica. And he ran in the back and he got a piece of paper and a pencil. He goes, start writing. I said, I don't know what to write. He goes, write a letter. So I said, dear God, you know. And then he said, write down all the things you've just been telling me. You're scared. You're going to be in trouble. You're going to go to jail. You're going to have no money. You're going to divorce, all this stuff. And I start writing that stuff. He goes, I'm resentful because I have fear, blah, blah, blah. So I wrote that down. I go, what do I do with it? And he goes, I don't know. So I wrote, love, Kurt, folded it up in my pocket, you know. And I walked down the street, going back to this hotel, and there was a Rite Aid there, and I wanted an ice cream. I hadn't had an ice cream in decades, right? Unless it was beer flavored, I think. But, you know, I mean, and all of a sudden it hit me. What a selfish, self-centered, arrogant, self-seeking jerk I had been. And it's not because other people didn't do things to me. And this is a very important point. Is anybody's walking up to 2, 3, 4, and 5 in the steps of your sobriety. What it was, yeah, I did put myself in position for other people to hurt me, and they were oftentimes not the best of people, but that's not what this was about. I saw my motives. I saw that I either was scared of what I was getting or not getting. I wanted more than my fair share. I wanted a little bit of extra comfort for me at times. I didn't know how society worked, so I literally would go off the beaten path, and I thought, why isn't everybody giving me the excuse? And that was usually the motive under everything I did. And when I looked at that, I was like, I'm free. I know the truth about myself. I don't give a damn what you think of me anymore. I know. You can't take this from me. So I kept writing, and I did a complete four-step on my 6 days of sobriety. And all I know is I've never, ever looked back on that without going, that was the magic. So what it did is it got me deeper into what everybody in AA was doing. Going to meetings on time, secretary meetings, pouring coffee, getting involved in service, talking with other alcoholics, all the things that we hear here. But there was a real purpose. It was like, oh, I'm growing for the first time in a long time in my life. I shared this with a young guy the other day, and there was a problem, and I hear this, and I've been to thousands and thousands of meetings, and one thing, and I've sponsored a lot of young guys, and there's this gap where I was missing 15 or 18 years of my life. So I kind of came in at 31, but I was really a 14, 15-year-old kid. My sponsor used to say that he stopped growing emotionally the moment he took a drink. I understood that. But I thought, well, how do I make this gap close? I don't get it. You know, and I would gripe about it a little bit, but there was no way I was giving up on my sobriety. There was no way I was not going to seek 50 years in this program. But I thought, I don't know how to get from point A to point B. And I really had to listen to my sponsors. And they would say, just keep doing the work. Just keep doing the work. And then there would be these periods of time where I felt all of a sudden 2, 3 years of maturity hit me at once. I'm like, whoa, okay, where most people kind of plug along and get it, I always get, whoa. And I was like, oh, that's what that feels like. I was being honest. I loved my honesty. I wasn't going to give that for nothing. And the integrity was growing, and the courage was there. And it was all growing, but I didn't still know how to grow up. So I really was growing up in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, some of the things that I share about, and I'll probably bring up here, is, you know, I was very fortunate to be around a lot of old-timers in this program. And one thing I saw was this is the long game. In the meeting we had last on Friday, in our meeting up in Ojai, the topic was willing to go to any length. And there's not a day that goes by where I don't think of that phrase for some reason. That just seems to be part of my story. But I think I was willing to face absolutely everything that came down the pike, and I just didn't give a damn what I looked like anymore. If I was late to a meeting, I got to the meeting. I didn't care. Oh, I didn't shower or clean up. I don't care. Get there. Get there. Get there. then after a while that became always, yeah, well, take the shower, clean up, eat, and then get to the meeting. You know, I mean, I was a little more on time, you know. And there was always the meeting before the meeting and the meeting after the meeting is where I came from, you know, and there was always some sense of service. And then we're talking about the purpose of the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, two or more gathered for the purpose of recovery, you know, and then things started to happen for me. One that was very tragic was my mother died on my 1 year of sobriety. I had given her first four cakes back in the 70s. She gave me my first one in 1993. But something inside of me said, that's life. Double down on AA. And I can remember being in bars where, I don't know how many times grandmothers died looking for a free drink from somebody. Oh, yeah, grandma died. You want to give me a drink? You know, I probably had 22 grandmas. And but in this particular thing, you know, with my mom, it was, you know, no, I'm in good company here. Look what she paved the way for. You know, and I knew instinctively she broke the chain and I was going to keep it broken, and that was just the way it was. And then success started to hit me, and that was new and different because it was earned. It wasn't fake. I was showing up on a daily basis for something, and some things were coming my way. And that was new and different. And I'd heard that what's worse for an alkie than bad fortune is good fortune. So you got to be careful of that one, I thought to myself. I got more involved in AA, more step work, more sponsoring. I moved back down to California. And some of this had happened up in Washington. So I moved back down to California and moved to Shell Beach, Pismo area. And I got actively involved in AA, and I was running all over the place. And I had made some money, so I didn't have to work as hard. And became a GSR, and then I became the DCM. And I used to run around with the DCM here from Area 52, District 52, when it used to be Area 5. So I was District 22, and these folks were District 22. And Carl Bynum was someone I used to go visit all the time, and I loved that man. You know, Bud H. was up in San Luis Obispo, was a dear friend of mine. I was telling Glenn a little bit about him. This is a gentleman that got sober in 1950. Both of them got sober in 50, and Blackie got sober in 49. And I would just hang with him. You know, I knew that was something special. My sponsor, and I say sponsor, because there was two gentlemen from the north of Canada. They got sober in 1964. And they both told me, they said, only one of us will sponsor you at a time because it's our experience. Guys will run around looking for what they want to hear. So only one of us will ever be your sponsor at a time. And Corky would take a shot at me and Bill would take a shot at me. But they were both laying out things I absolutely was sucking up. And I remember going to some meetings and there were some traditions being violated and something didn't sit right with me. It just didn't sit right. Something I didn't understand, but why are they having this cause for this one individual? I don't get it. And I ran back to Corky, and I said, Corky, this isn't making sense. And he starts laughing. He goes, please, please read AA Comes of Age. Please. And I said, well, I don't have it. And he goes, come on over. Coffee's on, as usual. And I ran over there. I got the book from him. I just told him the other day. I was just visiting him 2 weeks ago. And I reminded him of this story. Where I got over there, and I got home, I took the book. I had not finished a book since PT 109 in night when I was, John F. Kennedy's story when I was, 7 years old. That was the only other book I'd ever finished. And here I call Corky on a Friday night, and I go, I found the cause. I found what had happened. And this was somewhere in the middle of the book. He goes, it's a Friday night and you're home reading AA Comes of Age? What's wrong with you, boy? You would have never done this before. And I said, yeah, but I'm hungry. I want to know what the heck's going on with AA. You know, and became very material to me, very evident to me that I am a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and that we have to carry this on properly. You know, I knew I was in good company, but the people that had shared their experience, strength, and hope with me, the people that had raised me in the program. And these old timers, they didn't do it for me. They would say to me, if you want what we have, you will do what we did. And they did everything. So I thought, well, that means I have to do everything. Now, this is a lot of the groundwork of what I'm about to share is the, how things progressed of just going through anything in life. So whether you're 1 month sober, 1 day sober, 30 years sober, I'm 26 years sober, life's in session, things are going to come up, period. Deaths, births, marriage, divorce, taxes, jobless, success, more money, less money, moving, it's all going to happen. But I wasn't ever going to have a drink along the way. So when I moved down here, I had met another woman. We got married. After a couple years, we had a kid. And she went back out. She was sober. She went back out, and I was left with my child to protect her. And it was very, very, very important that I get full legal custody immediately, which I did. And I was doing this in the financial world, and I was just starting to climb in my professional world, and I was making a mark in my late 30s, and then bam. And all I thought was, okay, that part's over, on to the next chapter. So I raised my daughter by myself for 18 years. It didn't work, but here and there, I got her through some very emotional things that happened because of her mom. And I had the instinct of bringing the program with me the entire time. Just because some things had happened to her doesn't mean she does not have to grow up. Does not mean she doesn't have to face consequences. And it wasn't like, oh, I had to, you now have to. It was like, no, this is how I grew up. This is the blueprint for how you're going to grow up. So there is a little bit of a reward and consequence in life. She just turned 18. She'll be 19 in February. And she's second year of college. She's riding and competing with horses. She's working, you know, and she's got her head on straight. Mostly. There's still a teen in there somewhere. But while I was watching others continue on their paths and their professional careers where I knew I could have gone, I was like, that wasn't the hand that was just handed to me. Play the hand that was dealt. And I got stronger and stronger and stronger and more integrity and more courage. And to this day, you can't throw anything at me. I'm freaking bulletproof on all these emotional orders. I buried my mom. I buried my dad. I had a divorce that was very vicious because of her mom. Had to give up a lot of my hopes and dreams that were starting to develop because of early sobriety. I saw a lot of things happening, and then all of a sudden they seemed to have gone away. And I thought, well, so I went to my uncle at one point, and I said, you know, I was about 10 years sober, and I was a little upset one day, and I just was like, I've been through all this. Why is this happening to me? I had to vent one day, right? I had to bitch about something. And he looked at me and he just said, he goes, Kurt, this is just a period within a period. And he was telling me the story. His next door neighbor was Chuck C. And he was telling me about Chuck, how all of a sudden, after so many years of sobriety, the pension he had lived on went belly up. And he had to go back to work at 75. And he goes, you think this guy wasn't working a program? You're working a program. Kurt, you're in another league now. And it's not a hierarchy or a race around here. What I'm trying to say is this thing just constantly keeps unfolding. And we have to keep leaning into the program. And the program has been infallible since day one. And the one thing I shared on Friday is, and I've been sharing it a lot the last 8-10 years, is that I remember day one. And why I remember day one so vividly is because when I got to day two, I realized I made one. And when I got to day three, I had made two. And it kept going from there. And I got to tell you, every morning I wake up, I keep thinking, it just keeps going this way. But I never forget what worked on day one is going to work now. You know, I've watched a lot of folks turn their back on the program. They get a little of everything. Like my uncle used to say, they get the bedroom privileges back. And they get their jobs. They don't get fired. They get a few bucks their way. And AA and sobriety starts to kind of just a little bit go to the backside for a little bit. That's dangerous. I think that's dangerous. You know, I'll share something a friend of mine says. He was down in Santa Monica, and he would say, you know, I mean, I don't like to quote the book. I know the book, but I'm not one of these quoters, although I can. But on page 30, second paragraph, first sentence, we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves, and that's the first step in recovery. But it's different than step one, where it says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. I've watched a lot of people come in and go, I'm alcoholic. But they don't know what they're admitting to. You can't admit something you don't know. I can admit to you I'm a 7-foot NBA basketball player, but I don't really know that. I can tell you that, but it's not true. That concession, that inner knowing, that thing that sent my compass north, that sent my compass points to AA. It just does. And it's because of those simple, basic elements of when I got sober, I did not want to be the guy I was in the rearview mirror. I was willing to do anything to keep from being that guy and go forward. And along the way, I was willing to pay whatever dues I owed back there so I can be free. And along the way, everything started to really unfold. I became accountable. I became a worker among workers. I became a good son to my dad. Here I was raising my daughter. I had her in diapers. I went back to school to finish my master's. I have her in diapers, and I'm flying up to Washington to take care of my dad, who's falling down every 2 weeks. And I'm thinking, okay, my higher power, he must have made a mistake. He made me way too strong for this, because this is not my normal being. But yet, here I am capable of doing that. That only comes from AA, as far as I was concerned. For a guy like me. I know there's others out there that do it, but for a guy like me, what I brought to AA, that was AA's doing. Told me to suit up and show up. And again, I just kept being more responsible, more accountable. You know, and I watched some of that with my daughter, and I watched some of that with my friends, and I watched some of that with people I've known and work with. And I realized that oftentimes they're turning towards me because of accountability. They're turning towards me because of my consistency. They're turning towards me because I've got this sort of hope and vision of things are always going to be better. That's what I saw in all those old timers when I walked in that meeting in 1976. Everybody seemed to have this glowing hope. Even they were griping, they were still going somewhere. You know? I never want to back away from Alcoholics Anonymous. So, whatever year it is and whatever day it is, I know I have to keep doing this. I still need to stay connected. I still have to have my covers pulled now and then. You know? On the ride up here, Heidi were in the car, and I just knew just call my sponsor. Now, a couple weeks ago, I was fortunate. I hadn't seen my sponsor in a while. He's up in Vancouver, and I flew up there. Here's a guy that's 87 years old. He just turned 54 years sobriety in AA, and he's running around like a kid. I can barely keep up with him. He's going, "We're going to another meeting." I'm going, "What about dinner?" No, meeting. Jeez, all right, Corky, come on, let's go. You know, and I see the life. I see the life. My mom died from a tragic illness or a tragic surgery. But she was alive at 64. I couldn't keep up with her, you know? My daughter says something very nice to me. I'm 58, but she says I look a lot younger than that. And she goes, "Dan, you haven't changed." I feel like I'm 30. I know I'm not, but I feel it. I feel that sense of hope and that there's this future coming. All I have to do is just keep doing this, you know? A couple guys I've sponsored for a very long time. One just had his second kid. The other one's doing fantastic with his two kids. Their marriages are great, you know. And they call me to thank me. And I'm looking at them like, "No, man, you guys did the work." They said, "Yeah, but you're the one who kind of cornered us in a parking lot after meetings and wouldn't let us go." And I was like, "You're damn right I won't." You know, getting in their face. Because if someone wants recovery, I'll go to the wall with them. And I'll share one last moment here. A guy in early sobriety, a guy named Bob, who knew how to deal with a guy like me in the first few, you know, I was coming off a lot of booze and a lot of other poisons. Everybody said, "You're the one, you have to talk to Bob because none of us can handle you." And he says, "Well, I'll work with you." But, you know, I'm not always thrilled with working with people who's got a sibling or a parent in the program, because they tend not to listen. They want to do things their way. And he goes, we do want to meet and read the book once a week, and you have to call me in the middle of the night. And I thought, okay, well, the first part, whatever, okay. We go to a Wednesday meeting. We go into this little Italian restaurant, sort of upper-end Italian, a little romantic or whatever, and he'd have me read the big book to him out loud and slowly. And as soon as I start getting kind of quiet and speeding up, he'd go, I said out loud and slowly. And I'd be reading, and I'd just finally, I was just reading this thing out loud. I'm sure that some of the couples were not really thrilled with this, but, you know, someone was probably getting proposed to, but whatever. And then everybody said, have you called Bob in the middle of the night? I went, no, that's stupid. Why am I? I'm not going to do that. No, you have to call Bob. He'll stop working. If you don't call Bob, he's not going to work with you anymore. I went, what? That's dumb. I'm around all the time. We're talking. I'm going to step. What are you talking? You better call him. So I was up for some strange reason in the middle of the night. Couldn't sleep. I don't know why. I thought, okay, I'll call Bob. 3:30. I'll wake him up right in the middle of the best part. I'll wait till it's the ultimate. First ring. How's it going? I go, Bob. He goes, Kurt, I just wanted to make sure you knew you could call me at any time. Click. All I could tell you is the people I was around were living the program. They weren't fooling around. You know, and I hope I've instilled some of that in myself. You know, I don't ever want to mouth this thing. I never want to just raise my hand to something that I'm not doing. You know, I need to have my covers blown sometimes. 26 years of sobriety, I've watched a lot of guys get very cocky. And that's not the guy I want to be. I want to stay right-sized. You know, and I would hear things about wearing wearing sobriety like a comfortable old shirt. You know, and some of the old timers I knew, that's exactly what they were like. When I had first moved down here, by the way, I really didn't want a lot of time on my hands. I was still sort of lonely. So I lived up in Shell Beach, but I would put a speaker tape in and I would drive down to Los Alamos to my home group on Thursday nights. And there was a bunch of old timers back there then. There was Al and there was Barry W. and there was a whole bunch of, you know, and Bunny is still around. And yeah, and she and I talked now and then. And you know, and then listen to a speaker tape all the way back, and I figure, oh, that's 3-4 hours safe, you know. And I caught myself yesterday doing the same thing. Yep, just take a break in the day and just be sober, you know. And I was listening to some words from Norm A, and that's what he said, just try to be a little bit better today than I was yesterday, you know, and help someone else try to get through another day. Thank you very much, Glenn, for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, let's give Kurt another hand, huh? Good job. All right, I'd like to welcome the newcomer, Omar. Thank you so much for being here. Keep coming back, man. We'd like to see you. Thank you so much. And then Fred from the Pomo. I guess he stepped out, but he's not here. All right, so the birthdays, Heidi for 11, Lindy for 21, and Ann for 30.